This is David Price, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee via Skype on the 21st of February 2013. David Price, Part 2.
There was another medical issue with Yap. Yaps is his name? Yaps?
Yeah, Yap, really, but we all called him Jack. We called him all sorts of things, but Jack, he answered to Jack.
What was that story?
Yeah, he had an abscess on his tooth, and we had to run a DIY program to get his tooth out with radio help from our radio doctor, David Jones at Argentine Islands.
Did he know about dentistry at David Jones?
Well, he said he did, but he'd never taken a tooth out, so one has to wonder.
Tell me about the process. Did you
on that particular thing? We all drew straws for the see who was going to pull the tooth out. Poor old Alan Cameron got the short one, and I got the next short one, so I had to be the nurse. Alan Cameron, Mike Crockford, rather, had to operate the radio. He couldn't bear the sight of blood, so he had to turn away, but he operated the radio. And that was it. Alan Cameron and I did the medical bit, with Alan doing the pushing and shoving to get the tooth out.
What did you do for anaesthetic?
Well, we filled Jack up with whiskey or brandy, I can't remember which, and a couple of cocaine pads on either side of the tooth.
Did it come readily, the tooth?
No, not at all. It was a real tussle. The doctor told us to not to turn the tooth because it would be a double molar. And when Alan eventually got it out, it turned out to be a single molar. But anyway, it got out, and we gave Jack some antibiotics or penicillin or what it was and tucked him off the bed, and he was all right in a day or so.
Was there an audience for this operation?
I think everybody that could get to a radio were tuned in, listening to it all. And, of course, the radio operator at Base F, made a tape recording of it anyway.
Oh, did he? I wonder where that is now.
I've got a copy of it here somewhere.
You've got a copy yourself, have you?
Of the tape recorder of it, yeah. Alan Cameron had a copy too.
Oh, right, okay. I'll ask you about that.
You can give him a call and ask him what about the tape
for the archives.
It's tooth.
Yeah. I read somewhere that because it was an audience, there were some sound effects introduced into this operation.
Oh, well, we played it up a bit. Although I couldn't say that for poor old Jack, because he was the one doing the suffering, and I can assure you that the moans and groans from him were quite genuine.
Yeah. And then when the tooth was finally extracted...
When the tooth rattled into the dentist's bowl at the end of the operation, I think that was a nut and bolt or something like that that would make a suitable clunk.
So it was a theatre in more than one way then?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about the Beastie work. I know you were providing the power for this work to be done, but were you also... Yeah. Gathering, were you learning about the process at the same time, the work they were doing?
Well, I was interested in what they were doing. They were always behind the eight ball, so they couldn't spend too much time telling me about the ins and outs of it all. But basically, it was a radio radar transmitter that transmitted vertically rather than across the horizon.
But did you understand? Did you and the other non-ionospheresists understand why they were doing it?
Yes. It was to, as I say, sound the density of the various ionospheric layers and the echoes that returned from the transmissions were photographed, which were then developed on bass in the dark room. And then Alan Cameron and Jack Tinbergen, the bass part of the most part of their job was to analyze the traces on that. And it was a system called reduction, they called it. And get or tabulate all the results which got transmitted by radio to Port Stanley and thence on to the CSIRO in Slough.
In where, sorry?
Slough in London.
Slough, yeah. Okay.
Slough.
And did you have a sense that this was, you were a small cog in a huge research process?
Well, we knew that we were doing our bit, and we were also doing other stuff. I mean, there was a series of experiments for an American organization on whistlers. I don't know if Alan might have told you about whistlers, but that went on all the time. We made recordings of that on the hour. On magnetic tape. We weren't involved in the processing of that. That all got packed up at the end of the year and sent off to America. But apparently, the results from Port La Croix were better than they got from anywhere else in the world.
Was that because of its location?
Oh, I suppose partly. And also the incidence of these things that generate whistlers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the quality of the people doing the recordings, no doubt.
Oh, of course. Of course.
You had your own interest in radio, didn't you? I think, were you a radio amateur, David?
Well, I wasn't until I got to Port La Croix.
Yeah.
And I was interested. In the second year, I built a transmitter with help from Alan and also from Paul Leake, and we use that a fair bit, and I managed to send messages as far as Scotland from the Antarctic, which pleased us greatly.
Did the when the Beasties were in operation, did they interfere with the radio ham work?
Oh, well, we wouldn't do it when, I mean, mostly it was on the hour, every hour, so we knew that we had to stop mucking around on the airwaves whilst that was going on. And on world days, we wouldn't do it at all. But we fitted in, you know. I mean,
were you able to have worthwhile conversations with the other radio hams, or was it just a simply case of recognising that contact had been made?
Oh, well, there was always a fair amount of talk and banter and things. Sometimes some of the chaps managed to get onto a ham that was close to their home, although it was really not allowed. Messages got passed. And sometimes parents got on the radio.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yes.
So were your parents able to do that?
I shouldn't say that. No, no, no. My parents lived in Barclay, which is on the dark side of the moon compared with the rest of the UK.
But there were conversations between FIDs and their relatives back home.
Oh, some, yes.
Yeah. That's nice, isn't it?
Oh, well, it was, yes. I'm going to say some of them had regular contacts, like once a month or something like that.
So being in touch with the outside world was quite important then. Were you following the world events of that time?
Well, we had shortwave radio. We would listen to the BBC World Service when we could get reception, or the Voice of America or something like that. We were well up to date with it all.
I think there were instances where sometimes you listened to two different radio stations who gave you different stories about the same event.
Oh, of course.
Can you elaborate on that?
It was just, I suppose, different nations had different slants on things and the way things were done.
What kind of things did you talk about on base? There was a library where you sometimes would go as a group to meet and discuss things?
Well, there was a lot of reading done on base because we had a good library, but we had lots of discussions. We talked about our life. I mean, Jack talked about his life in Holland and the fact that his family had suffered fairly badly in the war. His father got locked up for a couple of years by the Germans and didn't stop him from winning the Nobel Prize eventually.
So you talk about Barclay and Gloucestershire, would you?
Oh, we talk about this and that and our interests and our girlfriends, those of us that had girlfriends, and the football teams we followed and our interests. Alan Cameron was a great jazz enthusiast. I belonged to an operatic society. Jack was interested in classical music. We were never short of things to talk about. And we played cards. And cribbage was a great card game. It was a great game we played and things like that.
There was
chess.
Quite an extensive LP collection.
Well, I don't know what it's like there nowadays, but in our days, well, what happened? A standard sort of issue from FIDS, and we all supplemented that with our own offerings. So we got quite an eclectic taste.
What did you take down there?
Oh, mostly Gilbert and Sullivan.
And I'm dying to know what FIDS felt was an appropriate record collection to put on base. Can you remember any of the LPs that were there before you
Oklahoma. That was one of them. Oh, one of the two more popular classics and things like that. That was all. It was fairly limited. I mean, they couldn't give us a huge collection.
And you built your own transmitter for the amateur radio work. Was that a set?
Yes.
Was that the? I'm not clear if that was the very first ability you had to use amateur radio, or whether it was a second transmitter later on.
Well, the transmitter came in the second year, actually.
Yeah.
The first year we used the base transmitter. In fact, we used the base transmitter mostly. The transmitter that I had was very much experimental.
Tell me a bit more about it, David.
Oh, well, there's not a lot I can tell. I mean, it was built on well-defined and classical lines as far as a radio transmitter was concerned. But we had to make it up using scrap bits from the Beastie and things and other electronic bits and pieces that were lying around. So, you know, it wasn't very sophisticated.
But it worked.
It worked. The modulator used to give us most trouble. I wouldn't have got through loud and clear like I get through to you.
No, well, it is more than half a century later, isn't it now?
Yeah, well, it's exactly so. And it was all thermionic valves and things like that.
So no transistors then?
Oh, no, long before the invention of transistors.
So, but it was still quite reliable, the radio communication, because you were so dependent upon it, weren't you?
Well, it was reliable up to the point of ionospheric conditions, which is why we were there. all these ionospheric readings that were eventually transmitted and collated were worked up into what was called usable radio frequencies, and for different times, because a lot of it was dependent upon the activity of the sunspot cycle. And that's why the IGY was when it was at that time. It was a period of maximum sunspot cycle, which could be very disruptive in terms of radio communications.
And you suffered then fluctuations in your ability to communicate, did you?
Oh, I'm sure on occasions, yeah.
Alan Cameron said that he had a fantastic first year in 58, but 1959 was a lot quieter, a lot more routine for him.
Well, oh, that's right. There were, well, we didn't have the excitement. We had no generators to build. We had no generating shed to build. We had no sickness with all the... Not that that was exciting. That was a drama. But, you know, there was a lot happening. And the second year, with two different blokes, because Jim Muirsmith left and Jack Timbergen left and Paul Leake and George Lewis came in.
How do they fit in?
And they were different kettles of fish altogether.
Can you talk about that a bit? How did they settle?
And have you spoken to Paul or anybody like that?
I've not spoken to Paul or George, no.
No, well, George is dead anyway.
Right.
And has been for a number of years. Yeah, well, they came in. They were diametrically opposed as personalities, I suppose you would say. And it took a while for them to fit in. George had come to FIDS. He'd worked in Germany as a technical translator. And he was an avid enthusiast for everything German. And the German efficient, the efficient German way of doing things. Which to us, just after the war... 1959, 10 years after the war maybe, but it still rankled a bit, and he got on everybody's nerves quite a bit. Paul was an easygoing bloke, bit scruffy, but, you know, he was easy. He was a good friend, easy to get on with.
There was complications with George's messages to and from home, I believe.
Oh, I don't know much about that.
Well, he was wanting to send messages in Morse in German.
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't involved in that.
Okay.
I can't comment because I don't know.
So was it...
Now you mention it, I remember there was something, but it was not something that penetrated my psyche.
So was the bass less harmonious on the second year?
Oh no, not less harmonious. Yeah. We got on. We got on well. In fact, I was a very good friend of George. And we used to correspond after we both got home. I used to go and see him, okay, when I was in England. And used to see him. No, I used to see Alan too. So, yes, it was harmonious enough. It was just that old George was a bit older than the rest of us, and he was somewhat irritating, we found, that was all. But not to the point of being acrimonious.
Now, they weren't the only other people on board base. There was a cat and a dog as well.
Ah, yes. Alan brought down a cat, which the wife of the colonial secretary had given him. It was christened Bridget. For some unknown reason. And then later on it had a name change and it became Dizzy, which I believe was named after one of Alan's girlfriends. But don't quote me on that.
Well, he mentions it too. In fact, he got a Dear John letter from Dizzy.
Yes, that's right, about 2 weeks after he arrived on base. Bit rough, I thought that was.
Well, was this a case of opening some drinks and being of moral support to him?
Well, we didn't have enough drink to give people moral support. But we all felt sorry for him, but we jollied him along, shall we say.
And the dog?
The dog, Peso?
Yeah.
Well, the Peso came from the Aero Survey Expedition. They gifted it to Port Lockroy. Peso was a beautiful dog. I thought he was. She was. She was a cross between Border Collie and something else. I don't know. She was liver and white, dark liver and white dog with a very nice personality. And She got on well with everybody on bass except George Lewis. And she bit George one day, and she'd never bitten anybody else. That dogs can sort people out. But anyway, poor old George got bitten for one reason or another. Mm. I'll put it like that. They were great. We wouldn't have. Base was a much better place with those two animals there.
Oh, good. Yes. Yes. Mm. How were relations with Bass HQ and SecFids and those distant people who were supposedly running your lives?
Those distant people who always got everything screwed up.
Well, go on, tell me more about it.
Oh, well, they did. I mean, I can't give you instances, but it always seemed that you'd open a packing case and what was inside bore no relation to what was on the manifest and things like that. Poor old SecFids got the blame for everything. And that was the way it was. They were the whipping boys, really.
Yeah. Was it a serious resentfulness or more jocular?
Oh, well, when we had to have a moan and complain about somebody to get the dirty water off our chest, we would blame SecFids. Mm.
But within the base itself, though, you hinted earlier that it was very much a democratic management of the base.
Very egalitarian, yes. We got on extremely well as a team. The base leader, who was, when we got there first, it was a chap called Clem Clements, and then Jim Muirsmith took over from him, and when he got sick towards the end of the year, they made Alan base Cameron, and Alan as base leader, and he remained base leader for the second year. And of course, it was all a very relaxed sort of outfit.
So what was the most stressful thing for you then in your time down there, David?
Well, for me, I suppose the most stressful thing was to clean up those engines and get them right so that they ran properly and on the electrical side of things, get them running correctly. That was stressful at the time because it was something that nobody looked for and it was a big problem at the time.
A big problem?
Well, a big problem in as much as we could have done without it, and we had to continue running the old generators and things like that, which were really noisy, and whereas the listers, you couldn't hear them running when they had the door shut.
So the big stress was waiting for the control boards to arrive, the switchboards to arrive.
Oh, well, that was all part of it. It was all very frustrating. I mean, it was something that was out of our control, really. I mean, nothing much we could do.
Coming from a long line of ship's pilots, did you get much boating in whilst you were down there?
Oh, we did a fair bit of boating around the place. Alan Cameron was a keen boating man, and Mike Crockford spent half his life in a boat, so we all knew what we were doing.
How reliable were the boats and their engines?
I consider that 2.5 horsepower in that sort of environment, which was what all we had in the way of a British Seagull outboard motor, was puny. And, you know, we used to turn our nose up at everything the Argentinians had, not whilst they were there, of course, but they had a British Anzani engine in their boat, which was 15 horsepower, which was much more useful for if you got caught in ice or anything like that. You could push your way through with a little Seagull. They wouldn't pull the skin off a rice pudding, really. Mm. They were fairly reliable, as long as you kept the fuel mixture right.
And did you get far?
Well, we just dodged around, got round as far as Dorian Bay and places like that, down the Peltier Channel and all around. We didn't try anything. We didn't try and do a Shackleton.
comparing yourselves to the Argentinians then, they had a doctor, they had fresh meat, they had decent outboard motors. Did you feel at any time that the British men were being treated as kind of slightly second-class citizens by our government?
Well, I think a lot of it harks back to the way things used to be in the heroic days, when if there was a hard way, the British did it the hard way. It has been ever thus. That was the way I saw it. If there were two ways to do things, an easy way or a hard way, it was felt that it was there was more kudos in doing it the hard way.
So, if
but that's only a personal view.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm after. So, was that just character building, or was that a sense of deprivation that you didn't have?
I'm sure it was character building.
Yeah. You said in your book that you learnt a lot about yourself in those 2 years down south, and I was just wondering whether you could summarise what you felt.
I was a country boy. We'll put it like that. I lived in deep country, in amongst farmers and people like that, and I lived a quiet, sheltered life. And suddenly, I was thrust out into a world of men.
Did you feel you matched up to them?
I could hold my own, I suppose. Yeah. I said to Alan Cameron subsequently, when I was writing these books, I said the trouble was in those days I was green. And he said to me, "You were never green." So I must have matched up to the rest of them somehow or other.
What do you think happened inside you in that time?
Well, don't forget, we were growing up, of course. I mean, I was 21 when I got on the ship, 22 when I got off the ship at the other end. And, it's going through a very formative time in one's life. So one becomes slightly more mature as we get older. Some of us never learn.
One of the most frequent things is that FID say they became a lot more self-reliant after their time down south.
That would be right. You wouldn't go around looking for somebody to get you out of a fix. You'd have to get yourself out of a fix, whether it be the job, burning the cakes in the oven, or the exploding asparagus.
As the time approached for you to start coming back home again, what were your feelings then about the Antarctic? Were you sorry to leave, or was 2 years long enough?
I was keen to get home at the time, but it wasn't long before I realised that up until that time it was the best years I'd spent in my life. Maybe because they were closer in timescale than anything else. I took a job after having a holiday, after getting back, I took a job in Bath with a company called Stothart & Pitt, and I worked in their design office for a while, and after about a month or two, I got fed up with that. I couldn't stand the regime, the regimentation, whereas life in Port Lacroix had been free and easy, and you made your own decisions about things, about life. Having to work in an office really felt like having a tight dog collar around my neck. And so I applied for a job in Malaya.
So it was a bit like going back to school, was it, going back into an office?
Well, you know, you were expected to do things certain ways. There was a company way of doing things, and I don't know. I suppose after a life of FIDs, one just didn't fit into a routine environment. That's what it amounted to, really.
So, hence this application to Malaysia, or Malaya as it was then called. What were you applying for?
To be an engineer on a tin mine.
Was that something you knew about, or was that a new departure?
I knew absolutely nothing about it. If we all wait until we know about things, we'd never do anything. No, I didn't know about tin mining. I knew that Malaya mined two-thirds of the world's tin. I knew that they had what they called an emergency on their hands where tin miners were being murdered, but I was assured by one of the partners of the company I was joining that that was all over now. I thought a different culture, a different climate, a different job. And I became a lowly shift engineer, which in, as a European is about as low as you can get in the echelons of tin mining for a European, an orang putih, as they call it. And I started as a shift engineer. But I quickly figured out that by taking a few examinations, I could be, soon become qualified to be a bigger and better engineer, we'll put it like that. And that's what I did. I spent the best part of 3 years learning the job. I was working on a tin dredge. I don't know if you know what a tin dredge looks like, except if you've seen a picture in the one book.
Well, tell me what it does.
Well, it digs out, it digs soil and tin and everything out of the ground and passes it through a treatment process, and it's all on a big floating pontoon. The particular one I went to, first of all, called Hong Kong Tin, was, well, it weighed in at about 4,500 tons. Mm. So you can see that it's not a, a small affair. And it would dig below the surface to about 135 feet, which was a long way down. And that brought a whole new range of technologies for me to learn, processes to learn, new languages to learn to make myself understood.
Very different, a very different climate to cope with.
Oh, yes. It wasn't a difference. That didn't seem to bother me in the slightest. I have to tell you nowadays, I can't stand the cold, and I can't stand the humidity or the blinding heat that we get here sometimes. So whatever it is, we don't carry it all the way through life.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was no problem.
Were there things you think that you learnt about life or yourself or working with people in the Antarctic which you were able to apply to your new career in Malaysia?
Well, eventually I got in the situation where I was in charge of blokes, fellows, other Europeans. I also, in the beginning, I had about 30 of mixed race, Chinese, Malays, Indians. I had to learn their language very quickly so that I could get myself understood.
But were there skills or attitudes that the Antarctic provided you with which you then were able to use later?
Oh, well, I was self-reliant. I didn't have to run to the boss every 2 minutes. I got on with the job, I guess. That was it. Also, I put up with the idiosyncrasies of some of my fellow men. And if you go east, you'll come across a lot of idiosyncratic people.
Just to cut a longish story short, you of course fell in love and then ended up in Australia.
Ah, well, that's a different... It was when I was in Malaya. Yes, I met Helen. She worked for the Australian High Commission, the diplomatic service. She was a secretary in the Australian High Commission there. It was very interesting because my company, Osborne and Chapel, they were called, a company with Cornish roots, were very protective of their young engineers. We weren't allowed to marry during our first tour of duty, which was for 3 years. And even then, afterwards, the prospective wife had to be vetted by the company, by upper management of the company, the partners, if possible, to see whether she would be a suitable wife.
Did she pass? And,
did she pass?
Of course. Flying colours. I got to be chief mechanical engineer, so she must have said the right things to the right people.
How did you come about moving to Australia?
Well, Helen was Australian, is Australian. I am Australian these days.
Yeah.
And having had my mouth widened and my brains removed, we always decided that when we married, we would come to live in Australia. It was a much more egalitarian country than England, with had all its class barriers and still things still then in the 1960s. And we wanted to live here. And so that's where we came.
And to bring the story full circle, you ended up working for Listers again in a fairly senior position.
I did. I got a job when I got to Australia. I had no job. I had to find myself a job. I joined English Electric Company, the English Electric Company, as it was called. And I worked for them for quite a while and got on well there. And but eventually, word got to me that Listers were opening a new branch office in Adelaide. Well, Adelaide, we were living in Adelaide, so that was quite convenient. And somebody gave me a copy of the advertisement for a state branch manager for the whole of South Australia and the Northern Territory. So you take the middle slice out of Australia. It was to run that for Listers. And so I applied, and I got the job. And we stayed there for a while. We bought a farm, lived on a farm, had a few animals. Our children were growing up. They loved the life in the country. And eventually my boss, who was an old naval commander, I rang him up one day and I said, "You know, Arthur," I said, "we finished restoring this old farmhouse. We can enjoy it now." He said, "Look, David," he said, "I'm sorry to tell you, but you better put it on the market." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Come over to Sydney and we'll discuss it." And I went over to Sydney as directed. And he said that he was retiring and that I was the anointed son. So they'd all done their homework and they got in touch with Listers in Dursley about me, and they all knew what I'd been up to in the Antarctic and everything. And they wrote back and said, "Have no fear with Price, he has an impeccable pedigree." I must say that's their words, not mine. That was their words. And so I became the anointed CEO of the company.
Almost a prodigal son, because you went away and came back.
Well, exactly. Well, they like that. Listers like that. They liked you to go away and learn the secrets of the opposition. And they thought that the fact that I'd been in English Electric for a while, I would have known a few of their diesel engine secrets, you see.
Looking, you said earlier that you thought that those Antarctic years were the most exciting years of your life. Is that still the case, or how do they rate in the life of Dave?
It would be run a very close first by Malaya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed my 7 years I spent in Malaya. I thoroughly enjoyed the time there. I only got out in the end because the Malayan government were running a scheme which they called Malayanization. It was a determined and scheme to get rid of all the European expatriates that were in vital jobs in the country and replace them with locals. And I could see that the writing was on the wall, so I came to the end of my contract and I was talking with one of the partners one day of the company, and he said, well, are you going to sign this contract for another year, another period of a couple of years? I said, no. They said, why not? I said, I don't think there's a future for us here in this country. And he said, well, he said, if you ask me personally, I have to agree with you. I said, no, I want to get out whilst I'm still young enough to carve myself a good life somewhere else. And that's what we did. I went with their blessing. As I came away with Fid's blessing, by the way.
Yeah.
They gave me a letter saying that they were well pleased with the work I'd done at Port Lockroy. So that was pretty pleasing. So I think I made my mark.
Have you ever had the chance to go back south?
Well, there's always a chance. There's always a bit of... The only problem is the do-re-mi, isn't it? It's a long way from Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To go south, I have to fly to Argentina, and then go down to Patagonia, and then pick up one of the tour boats, and I'm not prepared to do that.
But do you keep in touch with Antarctic issues and people?
Well, I'm a member of Bass Club and all those things. I read the Bass Club reports and the Bass reports, and yes, I do. I keep up with it all.
So you're keeping a keen interest even now in how the Antarctic's faring and the climate change that's going on.
Oh yes. I don't. Everywhere I go, I have contacts in Malaya. I have contacts in the Antarctic. I like to keep an iron in the fire, because old habits die hard anyway, and you've got to keep up with these things.
Mm. Well, I think I've asked you everything I wanted to ask you, David. Unless there was something else that you particularly wanted to say.
No, not at all. I thoroughly enjoyed my time with Fids. As I think that the time we went, and I'm sure you've heard this from other people who went at different times than me, the time we went were the golden years of Fids. Mm. I thought we were our own agents. Life was free and easy. We had a base leader, but we weren't screwed down to our jobs. Nowadays, it is much more regimented. I mean, science is the thing, and the bases are run far more professionally than they were when we were there. But I'm not saying that they weren't professionally run. I meant that there's a far more disciplined regime than there were in those days.
Is that a pity?
Well, I suppose, I mean, the science is the reason for being there anyway, and so you have to do it in as professional a way as you can possibly do so, and everybody's on limited budgets, and all the money needs to go towards the science rather than maintaining a few blokes going round having, whilst they're doing a useful job of work, having a jolly good time at the same time, and...
Fids of your era sometimes say that they have a unique understanding of what it was like for Scott and Shackleton and his colleagues, because life for them was not that different from the heroic era.
Well, that has been said.
Do you agree?
Partially.
How do you mean?
I mean, our communications, although they would be considered to be crude by today's standards, were far better than anybody had in those days. And I think that the understanding of rations and things like that were far better. But, you know, to be on a small base with five people, no doctor, no cook, do everything yourself, was a wonderful experience, and I wouldn't have missed it for quids.
Well, thank you very much, David, for sharing it all with us.
Just one word I have to tell you before I sign off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That when I worked at Listers before I went to Fids, the manager of the marine department went by the name of Ernest Shackleton. That was indeed his name. We used to call him the Intrepid Explorer, for obvious reasons. Yeah, no, it was wonderful. Wouldn't have missed it.
And it's been great fun talking to you. So thank you so much.
Well, I hope that I haven't been too flippant, and I hope what I've said makes a certain amount of sense.